Everyone, this is episode 7 of Undisclosed, The State versus Keith Davis Jr. I'm your host, Amelia McDonald Perry, and this will be our last episode in the first half of this series. We'll be taking a short break with another Undisclosed miniseries airing in between, and then I'll be back on Monday, July 15th, as Keith's latest and hopefully last trial begins. Keith Davis Jr.'s first trial in February 2016 wasn't completely devoid of so-called bad facts for his defense. That is, facts, evidence, and witnesses that hurt his case. The worst fact of all has extended his time behind bars for an additional 3 years, 3 months, and 6 days as of this broadcast. The Baltimore State's Attorney's Office hopes to tack on another 50 years, that is, and they'll get their fourth crack at doing just that when Keith's next trial begins in mid-July. But before I get to that, and very soon, this episode even, I promise, allow me to quickly review the facts we've heard so far. After four postponements by the state, Keith's first trial was assigned to His Honor Judge Barry Williams, who had just presided over the hung jury trial of Officer William Porter, one of the six officers charged in Freddie Gray's death. Williams would later go on to acquit three more of the officers from his bench. Although Keith Davis Jr. was the first person shot by Baltimore police following the death of Freddie Gray and the subsequent community uprising, Keith's survival made him an uneasy martyr, let alone a totem for one person's political gain. Plus, unlike what happened to Freddie, there was no viral video footage or eyewitnesses, let alone ones bold and brave enough to speak out. However lucky Keith was to survive his encounter, it was his story against all of theirs. And his didn't get very far, thanks to the guard posted by his hospital bedside and then his immediate pre-trial incarceration. The police department very effectively controlled this narrative, just as they had done with Freddie Gray. Only this time, they didn't need to work nearly as hard. The first week, the police department wasn't saying much, and Keith had no choice. Then the second week, a slew of charges were filed. And that was that. That had started to change in the months leading up to Keith's trial, thanks to a woman named Kelly, his girlfriend at the time and now wife of 2 years. She had been on the phone with Keith during the shooting. Well, the last minute and 6 seconds anyway, long enough to know what police said wasn't true. Kelly was certain that once state's attorney Marilyn Mosby heard her side and Keith's, she would turn around and do the right thing for him too. Instead, Keith was indicted, and after months of silence, the state attorney's office granted Kelly an 8-minute interview. But before the two ex-BPD investigators sat down and hit record, one of them, the nice one, if you can believe it, asked what a smart girl like her was doing with a loser like him, and what glimmer of hope Kelly had fizzled completely. From pretty much that moment forward, Kelly stopped waiting for her chance to speak. She couldn't control whether Keith's story would fall on deaf ears, but what she could do was keep shouting it to any and all who were willing to hear. Local activist organizations like Baltimore Block and Baltimore Action Legal Team reached out to Kelly early on, offering their solidarity and support, legal, financial, emotional, and sometimes all three. Every time Kelly spoke, the circle around her grew wider, a truly diverse collective of people who have since become known as Team Keith. This counter-narrative they were driving conflicted so dramatically with what police said that Keith Davis Jr.'s case suddenly had the media's interest once again. When February 19th, 2016 arrived, what might have been a near-empty courtroom just a few months before was suddenly buzzing with interest. Brandon Weigel covered the trial for the now sadly defunct Baltimore City paper.
Shortly after, the activist group Baltimore Block had been in contact with Kelly, and they were saying that police chased the wrong guy into the garage. Mm-hmm. So there was sort of a lot going into that first case, a lot of back and forth, and a lot of questioning of the official story from the jump. What I heard from activists and from Kelly sort of informed, you know, what I wanted to hear more about, and you know, it raised a lot of questions about, you know, their central story. And so there were just all sorts of like weird inconsistencies, and just the fact that they had, you know, used such excessive force firing into the garage as many times as they did. There was just a lot. So yeah, I sort of went into it wanting to find out how both sides presented their story, their case.
The evidence and testimony presented by prosecutor Lizette Ringgold-Kirksey was supposed to prove to the jury that on the morning of Sunday, June 7th, 2015, Keith attempted an armed robbery, fled from police, and then threatened them with a gun from inside a mechanic's garage. There was no disagreement between the state and defense that Keith did end up inside Big Herb's Auto Repair in Park Heights that morning. That was a fact that everyone could agree on. The state and defense also formally stipulated to the fact that on and for several years before that Sunday in June, Keith was prohibited from possessing a firearm due to his prior felony convictions. Significantly belated was the state's mutual agreement that the only guns discharged in the garage that morning were Baltimore police issued, maintaining their contrary position until just before jury selection. Here's Megan Kenny, who's been a member of Team Keith since before the first trial.
They dropped the charge of discharge of a firearm because they realized that no shots were ever fired from inside that garage by the gun that they say Keith had.
That left prosecutors with 20 charges left to prove, 15 out of the original 16-count indictment from July 2015, including attempted armed robbery and 3 counts of first-degree assault, plus 5 additional prohibited gun charges added in December. Prosecutors had all the resources and a long list of mostly government witnesses. But from the very first day of testimony, many of the state's good facts, once questioned, stayed questionable, and some even flipped the script entirely. Charles Holden, the victim of the attempted armed robbery, testified that Keith did not look like the man who stuck a shiny silver gun in his ribs and tried to rob him that morning. He did not identify Keith in a photo lineup the day of the incident, and his description of the suspect's hair and clothing did not match Keith on that day or any other. This particular good fact for the state, it turned out, had never been a fact at all. Civilian witness Martina Washington testified she saw Keith seconds after he ran inside the garage. It was the gun she saw in his hand that made her run outside seconds later. It was square and black, Martina said in her statement to police and again in court, and she rejected the defense's suggestion it might have been a cell phone instead. But this bad fact for Keith became a little less so when Martina made the following admission.
Do you remember, again, looking at this, do you recall telling the police what hand the gun was in?
I don't remember. I see, that day I was drinking anyway in the day. And I was scared, I was frustrated, and they sitting down there saying all the stuff to you, and they keep telling you what they want you to say out their mouth and all of that.
I'm gonna actually take a look at page 20 of the transcript.
Okay.
Can you look at that?
I see what it says. I see what it says right there.
Up top. Can you just look at the whole page?
Okay, but I can't recommend that I said that.
No, I'm not asking you to recommend anything. I'm just asking you to look at the page to yourself.
Okay, I'm looking because I looked at it before. All right.
Okay.
I already know, but I looked over it.
Okay. So now can you recall, and looking at the transcript, telling the officers that you saw the gun in the right hand?
I don't recall that.
Okay. Do you recall telling the officers that the person was light-skinned?
I don't can't recall that even because I told you they was like telling me, is the guy light skinned? Was he light skinned?
Okay.
You know, then you like, yeah, I'm trying to get out of here. You know what I'm saying? That's what kind of mood I was in. Yeah, okay, yeah, I'm trying to get out of here.
Okay. But then looking at the transcript, when you said the gun was in the right hand, was that on your own accord?
What you mean?
with at the time, is that what you remembered when you said the right hand?
No.
So today you're not sure?
I'm not sure.
Martina's fiancé, Bernard Berkeley, he didn't see a thing and ran outside after Martina, so he had little to offer overall. But he did know the layout and lighting of the garage from inside and out better than anyone else.
And do you recall what the lighting was like in the garage?
Well, it was a Sunday and my father didn't do no cars that day. I just came there that morning to wash his van. And the lighting was dark in there that morning because all the lights was really off except the office lighting. Because he wasn't doing the work that day.
And at the time in question, back in June of 2015, you said the shop was pretty dark?
I mean, the lights was off in the shop because there wasn't no work being done. Only light was on, it was in the office, my father's office.
Is the office in the center of the garage?
No, far front of the garage.
So would that be in a corner of
the garage? Yes, in the corner.
And so the lighting from the office, you'd agree with me, doesn't illuminate the whole shop?
No.
Is there anything that you can see in front of you if you're standing outside looking in, other than the lift?
You can see the lift. I mean, if the lights are on, you can see in there. It was off that morning, so.
So if the lights are off, then you really can't see anything?
Not real good, no.
So if it's bright outside and dark inside, you really can't see anything?
Only thing you can see is the bay door open halfway down. You can just see right there at the beginning. Besides the light in the office that was on, that's all.
While even most of the officers admitted the lighting conditions made it difficult to see, that pesky detail hardly would have mattered if the cops had just stuck to one version of police say. Six of the police officers who were present for the shooting that Sunday in June, one after the other, were brought in to testify, including the four who fired at Keith. Officer Lane Eskins went first, and he came out of the gate cool, calm, and confident. But as was the case with every officer who followed, there were things he struggled to explain. Take, for example, his decision to leave the crime scene minutes after the shooting to find witness and victim Charles Holden.
When the incident was over, when the scene was secured inside of the garage, I informed Sergeant Santiago that we had a victim and Mr. Holden. I needed to go find the victim. I knew what he looked like, so I left the location inside the garage and I jogged back to St. Charles and Belvedere. When I got there, Mr. Holden wasn't there. He had gone.
You may continue.
When I got to St. Charles and Belvedere, Mr. Holden was not there. He had left the scene. I still do not know how to this day that our dispatcher got his phone number, but I asked the dispatcher if she had a number to contact him. I remember doing that. She said yes. I said, please call him. Have him come back to the scene. Moments later, the dispatcher told me that she was able to get in contact with him. He responded back to St. Charles and Belvedere, at which time I secured him. He was taken to the Northwest District, and I had an officer there. I appointed an officer to stand by him, and then he was transported down to headquarters to our homicide section.
Do you recall if at any point in time after Mr. Holden was transported, if you had a conversation with him?
When I got back to the scene and everything was over, our departmental policy is that they have officers transport us to our homicide section down to headquarters. As I walked in the door at the homicide section, Mr. Holden was standing in front of me and came over and hugged me.
And so in this case, you spoke with a Mr. Holden before he gave a statement, isn't that right?
I went and located him at the scene, took him back to the Northwest District, and he was, he was doing a lot of talking. I asked him not to.
So you asked Mr. Holden not to do talking, but you were doing the talking to him, right?
All I told Mr. Holden is that he was a victim of crime. We needed to secure him. He had to be taken back to the Northwest District, and he would be transported to homicide, and he kept telling me that he just wanted to smoke a cigarette.
Okay, so he didn't ask you if you got the guy?
Actually, I believe he did, ma'am.
And then you told him, yes, I shot him.
My response, I don't know. I know that I think he did ask me if we got the guy, and I said yes.
You said, yes, I shot him. Isn't that what you told him?
I don't know if that's what I told him, ma'am.
Did you also tell him that you don't know if the guy's going to survive because he's non-responsive? Didn't you tell him that, too?
I don't know if I told him that.
So if Mr. Holden represented to this court that you, in fact, said, yes, I shot the guy, would Mr. Holden be correct?
It's very possible, ma'am.
Now, in terms of what you told Mr. Holden, wouldn't you agree with me that you tell Mr. Holden, after him asking you, did you shoot the guy, or did you get the guy, you said, yes, I shot him. Don't you agree with me that you telling him that leads him to believe that the person you shot was, in fact, the person in his car?
Yes, ma'am, probably does.
And so before he actually gave a formal statement, you led him to believe that the person who was shot was definitely the person in his car, right?
If he took it that way, then probably.
And don't you agree with me that not only is that inappropriate, but it would taint his statement to the police, isn't that right?
It very well could, yes.
The order of the officer witnesses didn't seem to work in the state's favor. Eskins and his sergeant, Alfredo Santiago, both testified about nearly colliding on a block called Linden Heights Avenue, a block from where the foot chase began. This established Santiago as a third officer, in addition to Eskins and Catherine Philippou, who by virtue of his proximity could identify Keith as the armed robber. But in between these two witnesses, the jury heard from Officer Diana Brown, who the police department determined only witnessed the shooting, but did not discharge her weapon. Brown testified that her patrol car was just behind Santiago's Tahoe, from the Northwestern District Station to the garage. But their route had been via Reisterstown Road, one block closer to the west. If Santiago did see Keith running, according to Brown's testimony, it would have been in his rearview mirror. And there were no police officers behind him, at least during the time period when either of them would have been able to see. Brown and Santiago remembered several things very differently from the start of the shooting to the very end. One of the details defense attorney LaToya Francis Williams wanted to establish was just how loud the shooting scene was. The officers claimed to have been shouting various verbal commands throughout, but would Keith have even been able to hear them? And would they have been able to hear him? Here's her cross-examination of Officer Brown.
Now, when you arrived at Eleanor Avenue, you were driving in your vehicle, correct?
Yes.
It's a patrol vehicle?
Yes.
And you had sirens on?
Yes.
Did Sergeant Santiago also have sirens on?
I don't know if he had sirens on. A lot of times, there were other officers responding. A lot of times our cars can drown out the sound of other vehicles, so I don't know if he had his siren on at the time.
Now, when you were asked back in June of 2015 what you heard, do you recall responding that Santiago never turned his sirens off? It was loud?
I don't recall that, no.
Ms. Williams was only permitted to refer to the transcript of Brown's taped statement to the force investigation team on the day of the shooting, not actually play the audio itself. I, on the other hand, don't have to play by such rules. Officer Brown, may I refresh your memory?
The siren was on. In his patrol car, he never cut his siren off.
Okay.
It was really loud, and between the sirens, his siren on the truck that's like sitting right there.
Now that that's been established, a follow-up question from Ms. Williams.
Do you recall whether or not Sergeant Santiago ever cut his sirens off at the garage at Eleanor?
No, I don't recall that.
Brown wasn't asked this particular question when she gave her statement. And to be fair, whether Santiago turned off his own siren is not one of those details I would expect her to recall 8 months later. Sergeant Santiago didn't give a statement until a few weeks before the trial, but he did have several months in Puerto Rico to reflect on the details.
And when you got to Eleanor, you stopped your truck and you jumped out?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you have your sirens on at that time?
Yes, I got my sirens on.
Did you cut them off when you got there?
Another officer cut it off.
I'm sorry?
Another officer cut it off.
Another officer came into your truck and cut off your
sirens?
Yes.
When did you see this happen?
When I walked back to the door.
So you got to the garage.
Mm-hmm.
You jumped out right away. You went into the garage. And then when you came back out, another officer cut off your sirens.
I get out of my truck, I went to the back, grabbed the bunker, and then when Officer Eskins and me walk in, we walk out. When we walk out, we were on the door, and another officer cut the lights and sirens, everything.
So at that time, there were only two officers on the scene, correct?
Myself and Eskins.
Yourself and Eskins. And both yourself and Eskins went into the garage, right?
Yes, ma'am.
So who else was there to cut off your sirens?
Who else? When we were walking inside the garage, I remember seeing Brown coming in. I don't know what she wore out, and then all the officers were coming in.
So your testimony is that Officer Brown showed up and went to your truck and turned off your sirens.
Sustained.
I have difficulty believing this story, mostly because Santiago parked the Tahoe directly in front of the garage's bay doors. From a tactical perspective, the Tahoe effectively blocked the only possible exit and provided substantial cover for officers on the passenger side. But Santiago also left his driver's side door open. Remember, that's how Catherine Annie Oakley Philippou claimed she was able to fire her three shots through the inside of the SUV. I have my doubts, however, in this scenario, she was still taking cover behind the passenger door. In order to turn off Santiago's siren, either via the driver's side or the passenger's side, Brown wouldn't have had any cover at all. And if Brown had really taken such a risk to turn off another officer's siren, I'm guessing she would have remembered it on the day of the incident, at least. Then again, the same day, she also remembered handcuffing Keith alongside Officer Donald Burns. But then he told FIT detectives that Keith was already handcuffed when he went inside the garage after the shooting.
Burns pulled his handcuffs in and I was directly behind. He pulled his handcuffs out and then I was directly behind him. Mm-hmm. So they started advancing in and I guess he had laid down. He started to comply. He laid down on the ground, put his hands out. Burns went in. I remember I either took the handcuffs off out of his hand or something, but I assisted in putting the handcuffs on him.
When I went in, he was on the ground. He was bleeding. He was cuffed.
So you go in, and what's he doing?
He's on the ground. He's laid down. He's just flat
prone?
Out.
Yeah. Okay.
He's face down.
Face down. And what's happened?
We handcuffed him.
Did you actively handcuff him?
No. I don't even know who handcuffed him.
So you don't know which officers handcuffed him?
No, I don't know who handcuffed him.
At the armed robbery trial, Brown again testified that she and Burns did the handcuffing, and since the state didn't call Burns as a witness, there was no one to contradict her, except for Santiago, Lopez, and Eskins, who you'll hear next in that order.
And then it's when I put handcuffs on this person that was on the ground.
So you put handcuffs on the person on the ground?
Yes, ma'am.
Were they your handcuffs or were they someone else's handcuffs?
My handcuffs.
So you took cuffs off of yourself and put it on the person's arms, correct?
Hands, yes, ma'am.
Officer Santiago cuffed him, and Sergeant Santiago searched the individual, and that was it. We called for a medic.
Four of us went in. We secured him. My sergeant patted him down, make sure he had no other weapons. We secured him in a set of handcuffs.
I'm curious what listeners hear in that last clip of Lane Eskins, because what I hear is not what is written in the official court transcript. I hear him saying, "We secured him in a set of handcuffs," like he's not being specific, but the transcript says, quote, "I secured him in a set of handcuffs." See, this is why access to courtroom audio is so important. If Eskins did use the royal we, Brown still isn't a possibility. She wasn't among the three officers who went in with him, in his account. In Brown's version, when she and Burns go in to handcuff Keith, Eskins is still over by the right side of the bay doors.
America has fallen in love with Best Fiends, the 5-star rated mobile puzzle game.
discover the world of Minutia and its cute, courageous inhabitants in this fiendishly fun, free-to-download puzzle adventure. Now, I've only started playing Best Fiends this week, but I can already say it's addictive. I'm up to level 3, the Tempest Cave level, and the game is a great combination of battle games and puzzle games. With Best Fiends, you get a totally different puzzle experience. Solve thousands of fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. An epic storyline will keep you engaged with the world of Minutia. There's thousands of hours of gameplay. It's easy to learn, but difficult to master. There are thousands of levels to challenge, and you can challenge your brain with fiendish puzzles that require strategy to succeed. It's the perfect casual game to play alone or with family and friends. Best Fiends is the game to play. It's 5-star rated on the Apple App Store and Google Play, and there are over 90 million downloads globally. You can play offline anywhere, perfectly want to squeeze in another level on the go. So don't miss out on this must-play game of the year. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends. Play today.
Now all of the officers say Keith eventually surrendered, but how dramatically was up for debate. According to Santiago, Keith had nothing to say when he gave himself up and stayed totally silent while he was handcuffed. According to both their accounts, Eskins and Brown apprehended Keith separately from each other, yet they remember him having similar things to say.
Four of us went in. We secured him. My sergeant patted him down, make sure he had no other weapons. We secured him in a set of handcuffs. And as we rolled him over, I noticed that his left shoulder was pinned to his ear. I looked down and he had a phone up to his ear. I took the phone from him. I noticed on the phone it said Auntie. I placed the phone down to the left. At that time he turned around and looked up at me and the other officers and said, "You should have killed me."
And do you recall if you heard the defendant say anything when you were in the garage?
He said that you should have. He said that you should have killed me.
And do you recall if he said anything else?
He said that you should have killed me. I didn't have any bullets in my gun.
Eskins, Brown, and Santiago stayed consistent in their statements and trial testimonies, at least. But Officer Philippou went back and forth. According to her January 2016 statement to Internal Affairs, Keith had quite a lot to say.
Did you hear him yell anything at the police or say anything in response to you all?
I think when he got hit in the face, he said, "Y'all motherfucker shot me in the face" or something.
Okay. Did you say anything else?
No.
When you guys went in there, did he say anything while he was being handcuffed or on the ground or say anything to the medics?
I think when we were standing around him, he might have said something like, "You guys should have killed me" or something.
So Philippou was kind of on the same page as Eskins and Brown, at least originally. But then at the armed robbery trial, her testimony changed the story entirely. This time, the only talking Keith did was on his cell phone during the shooting.
What, if anything, was in his left hand?
I didn't see anything in his left hand. I just heard him carrying a conversation. And later on at the end, we realized he might have been on a phone call. But I think I saw on the phone it said like Auntie or Aunt, something like that.
So you looked at this person's phone?
It was on the floor, yeah.
Do you know who put it on the floor?
I think he dropped it, I'm not sure. I just remember seeing it after I walked in and the officers had him in custody and we called for a medic.
Now, at the time you testified that you heard him on the phone, is that right?
I heard him carrying a conversation. I didn't see the phone. And later on, I realized, I guess he was on the phone.
In his statement to Internal Affairs, Lopez also claimed Keith was on the phone.
Did he beg you guys to stop shooting at him?
He was on the phone the whole time. He didn't say anything to us. He just on the phone talking to whoever he was talking to.
Okay. Now, how long was he on the phone?
The whole incident. When we finally told him to drop the gun, he threw his phone on the ground.
By the time Lopez testified at the trial, he remembered who Keith's conversation was with.
What, if anything, did you observe next?
I observed the suspect pointing the weapon towards our general direction. So I discharged my weapon, being in fear of my life and my partner's.
And do you recall if you actually saw the weapon was actually pointed in your direction?
It was pointed to our direction, yes.
And at the time that it was pointed towards your direction, do you recall where you saw the defendant?
Yeah, yes, ma'am. He was behind a refrigerator inside a garage. He was holding the weapon with his right hand, and for some odd reason, he was also on his cell phone with his other hand.
Do you recall when you saw him on the phone?
He was on the phone the whole time. He was holding the phone with his left hand and pointing the gun with his right hand. And he was talking on the phone, and while myself and other officers were just yelling at him to drop down his weapon, and he wouldn't comply. And at one point, I remember Officer Eskins telling everyone to just be quiet so he could be the primary officer that yells out the commands to the suspect.
And so when the defendant was on the phone, you said he was speaking. Could you actually hear anything that he was saying?
No, I couldn't hear anything what he was saying.
So what, if anything, led you to believe that he was actually speaking on the phone?
Once he actually dropped the weapon and got on the ground and we went in to cuff the individual, Officer Eskins took the phone away from his hand, and on the phone, it was on like he was speaking with somebody named aunt or auntie on the phone.
Not a single witnessing officer who gave a statement on the day of the incident said anything about Keith being on the phone or paid attention to his phone at all. Neither did Santiago, who went AWOL for months. But Eskins, like Philippou and Lopez, testified that Keith was having a phone conversation with an auntie too.
You testified a bit earlier that after my client was shot, that you realized he was on a cell phone,
correct? No, ma'am. It wasn't until we went in to secure him and put handcuffs on that I realized there was a phone to his ear.
And when you say to his ear, you mean literally on his ear or resting on his shoulder?
Had his shoulder pinned to his ear.
And what was his hands doing?
He did exactly what I asked him to do. Placed his hands out to the side and laid flat on the garage floor.
And all while the cell phone was pinned to his shoulder?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you see where he was shot?
I couldn't tell. There was blood on his face, blood on his clothing, and blood on the floor. I couldn't exactly tell where it was.
So there was blood on the right side of his face?
Ma'am, I don't know where. There's blood everywhere.
In reference to what you saw on his face, was it to his right side or his left?
Objection.
Sustained.
Can I show you for identification purposes what's marked as defense exhibit 7? Do you recognize this?
It's a cell phone, ma'am.
But you don't recognize this from anything other than me standing here today?
I wouldn't be able to pick out a phone from one to another. It happened 6 months ago. I couldn't tell you that.
Was it your testimony a bit earlier that you looked at the cell phone that my client was on?
I sure did.
Do you recall what that cell phone looked like?
Nope.
I just did a very silly experiment. I am a person who has not been shot in the face or the arm or the back. I just pinned my iPhone 7 to my left ear with my left shoulder, got down on my hands and knees, crawled a few feet, and then attempted to lie down flat on my stomach with my arms out without dropping my phone. This last bit was the only part that really tripped me up. I couldn't keep the phone in place while turning my head in either direction to truly lie down flat. I kind of just kept my head hovered for a second and felt really stupid and uncomfortable, and I'm perfectly healthy and not injured. My dog stared at me concerned for a bit, and then she whimpered, and then she walked away. Her reaction said it all. This was weird, especially if, like Keith, you'd just taken a .40 caliber bullet to the face. Anyway, the crime scene photos show Keith's Samsung Galaxy on the floor towards the rear of the garage. At the very bottom, right next to the microphone, are two very small drops of blood, no bigger than a pencil eraser each. And that's it. At most, it looks like Keith answered the phone seconds after he nicked himself shaving. In contrast, several officers said in their statements that Keith's face and hands were covered in blood when he was taken into custody, and his Sinai Hospital records noted the excessive bleeding from his face. As for Keith's phone call with Auntie, according to his phone records, Keith doesn't have a contact named Auntie, but he does have several aunts listed, including Aunt Wanda. Wanda isn't really his aunt, that's just what everyone but her own kids calls her. Keith had left her house in Park Heights less than an hour before the shooting. Keith never called or spoke to Aunt Wanda on the phone that morning, during the shooting or at all, but she called 5 times between 10:02 and 10:12 a.m. The earliest call is more than 4 minutes after dispatch was told Keith was in custody and a medic was requested, and less than a minute before Eskins left the scene to find Charles Holden. Both Keith and Kelly's cell phone records corroborate they were on the phone with each other for just over a minute after he called her at 9:57 a.m. By the time Eskins, Philippou, and Lopez gave statements to Internal Affairs, Kelly's account of being on the phone with Keith during the shooting was well publicized. During the fall, Keith's phone records were subpoenaed, but then never became part of the robbery case. That's convenient, because my best guess is that the alleged phone call with Auntie was meant to dispute Kelly's account, knowing she'd likely be called to testify. And sure enough, she was.
I picked up the phone and Keith was screaming, "Babe, I'm gonna die." He said it repeatedly. I was asking him, you know, "What do you mean you're gonna die?" He said, "They shot me, the police shot me in my arm." I could hear like him yelling that, "Babe, I'm gonna die. Why are you trying to kill me?" And I could hear like a constant pop, 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 pop. I'm asking him, where are you? Where are you? What is going on? What do you mean he shot you? He's constantly yelling, "Babe, I'm gonna die. Babe, I'm gonna die." I heard fear. He was scared. He was screaming. He was crying. I heard fear. It was loud. I could hear sirens. I could hear the popping. And then the call drops. I kept calling over and over and over again. I kept texting. I kept calling. And I never got back through. Not himself. I found out he was shot in the face.
At last count, I probably had about 8 bottles of shampoo and 10 bottles of conditioner in my shower stall, because I'm pretty much never satisfied with hair products. I'm always looking for like that one, the one that like covers all of my needs. And yes, I do have hair under the scarf and it's lovely. However, as I get older, you know what? I want more volume. I want more shine. I want my hair to be healthy. And I finally found the right product, thanks to Function of Beauty. So Function of Beauty, the way it works, it's totally personalized for your head of hair. It addresses all your hair concerns, not just one. Like, you know, you go to the department store, or you go to the drugstore, it'll be like, "Oh, this shampoo is to preserve your color, or this one's to volumize." Well, you can actually decide, like, this is what I want my hair product to do. You can choose up to 5 hair goals to add to your formula. And Function of Beauty individually formulates every single bottle just for you, based on your hair type, your hair goals, and your preferences. One of the things I love the most is you can pick the color and fragrance of your hair product. Now, I know some people don't like dyes and don't like fragrances, and you can also get the hair products without it. But you know what? For me, I say load it up. I love my hair to smell good. But here's the thing. They have safe, natural ingredients, because Function of Beauty never uses sulfates, parabens, mineral oils, or any other harmful ingredients. They're also vegan and cruelty-free. And look, here's the thing. You might not know this, but the sad reality is that most major drugstore brands actually test on animals. But Function of Beauty is 100% vegan and cruelty-free. You get salon-level quality at a better price, over 40% less per ounce than the leading salon brands. It's not going to break your bank. Also, the bottles come with... Thank you, Susan, for reminding me. The bottles came with stickers. My daughter stole the stickers, but it's okay. They're stickers so you can decorate your cute little bottle. It's kind of adorable. Look, our listeners will get 20% off their custom formula. So to claim it, go to functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed right now and take a quick 2-minute hair profile quiz to design your 100% unique shampoo and conditioner formulas. Go to functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed right now and get 20% off your first order at functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed. Once again, that's functionofbeauty.com/undisclosed.
Keith's attorney, Ms. Frances Williams, intended on calling Keith's surgeon, Dr. John Cockanese, as an expert witness who would opine that due to his immediately fractured jaw from sustaining a gunshot to his cheek, Keith could not have said any of what the witnesses claimed. That sounds reasonable, right? Apparently not. During pre-trial motions, the state wanted to preclude Dr. Cockanese from testifying because the extent of Keith's injuries were, quote, irrelevant and had nothing to do with his defense of the charges. Furthermore, prosecutor Lizette Ringgold Kirksey argued, Dr. Cockanese, quote, was not there. He was not on scene. By the time he would have treated or saw the defendant, surgery would have been several hours later, so therefore I don't believe he would be able to testify as to what the defendant was able to do or not do at that moment on the scene. I gotta be honest here, my fatal flaw as a criminal defense attorney would be my absolute inability to hide my contempt from showing on my face at moments like these, which happen, I suspect, during every interaction with a prosecutor ever. So Judge Williams denied the state's motion. That was on a Friday. The following Monday, Ringgold Kirksey came into court with a different reason for precluding the surgeon's testimony. She argued the defense had not given the state the advance notice required for expert witnesses, which, as it turned out, was true, at least as far as Dr. Cockanese's participation in the trial was concerned. But the defense had issued an expert designation for Dr. Cockanese at the bail review hearing Keith had had in front of Judge Panos just a few weeks earlier. He was the judge who denied Keith's bail request, but issued that court order requiring the state to prioritize Keith's immediate medical needs, specifically having the bullet removed from its neck by none other than Dr. Cockanese. So the state had an expert designation for Dr. Cockanese, but for a separate proceeding, and they should have already been in touch with him for those reasons. A procedural oversight by Ms. Frances Williams, which in this particular situation did not leave the state at a real disadvantage, that was the basis of their renewed objection. The defense proposed two other experts that had been properly disclosed, both doctors who treated Keith at Sinai Hospital and would offer an opinion based on his medical records. But the state objected to them on different procedural grounds. Judge Williams got super annoyed that Ringgold Kirksey and Ms. Frances Williams couldn't work this out like lawyers, but it was the state who was unwilling to budge. Ringgold Kirksey realized, I'm sure, that when it came to the actual law, rather than negotiating skills, she had the upper hand in the situation. She no doubt knew that if the decision was put to Judge Williams, he would have to find in the state's favor, because the rules are the rules and the defense had not explicitly followed them. So after all that, the defense had no expert witness they could call to opine that Keith Davis Jr. could not have said any of the various statements the officers claimed once one of their bullets penetrated his face. The worst fact of all, the one mentioned at the top of this episode, is the Hammerley Trailside 22. It was definitely there at the crime scene. Photographs make that indisputable. The first photo where you can really make out the greenish multicolored handle, it was taken at 12:22 p.m., lying on top of the refrigerator with a small orange traffic cone to its immediate right and a brown leather wallet all the way to the left. The wallet is very likely Keith's wallet, though that has never been explicitly stated in court. How it got on top of the fridge has also never been explained. All of the officers who have testified that Keith put the gun on top of the refrigerator when he surrendered have never said anything about him taking out his wallet, too. It's not clear when the wallet got there, either, since in their accounts, it's absent even after Keith has been transported from the scene. Well, actually, there is one officer who confessed to seeing the wallet, Israel Lopez.
Officer Lopez, you just testified on redirect that you saw an individual placed the gun on top of the fridge. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you also see a wallet being placed on top of the fridge?
I don't remember about that wallet.
How'd the wallet get there?
I don't know.
Do you know whose wallet it is?
Wouldn't be able to tell you.
So when you observed a gun on top of the fridge, did you see a wallet too?
Yeah, I've seen a wallet.
Did you see who placed the wallet there?
No, ma'am.
Do you know how long the wallet was there?
I don't know.
I'm sorry?
I have no idea.
So in your testimony, you talked about this gun. Is the wallet close to the gun?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you miss the wallet in your direct?
Objection.
Sustained. Strike the question. Please ask.
ask another question, please.
Is there any reason why you failed to mention that there was a wallet placed on top of the fridge?
Objection.
Sustained.
Do you remember giving a statement in January of 2016?
Objection.
Sustained. Strike the question.
Officer, you didn't see my client place a gun on top of the fridge, did you?
I've seen him place the gun on top of the fridge.
No further questions.
Lopez's testimony is the most interesting to me. He doesn't spin a yarn like Eskins, but when he isn't responding to basic questions with, I wouldn't be able to say, little inconvenient truths tend to slip out.
Do you recall whether or not if the defendant had put the gun down?
Objection, Your Honor.
Yes, he put the gun on top of the refrigerator. He left it on the top there.
And did you actually observe that for yourself?
I observed it once everything settled down.
Okay, what does that mean?
Once he was cuffed and once the medics took him, I observed, and it was just to make sure it was a gun, and it was a gun on top of the refrigerator.
Just to make sure it was a gun, huh? Like there was reason to be unsure? Lopez wasn't actually asked to describe the gun at the armed robbery trial, but in his statement to Internal Affairs, he said it was silver or dark gray, which doesn't describe the Hammerly Trailside 22, aside from the silver slide. In an earlier episode, you heard how a few of the witnessing officers described the gun, but how about Eskins, Philippou, and Santiago, who all had multiple opportunities to get a good look at this weapon that allegedly made them fear for their lives? Santiago allegedly saw Keith with the gun in his hand on four occasions, running in front of the Tahoe at Linden Heights Avenue, crossing Reisterstown Road, running into the garage down on Eleonora Avenue, and then inside the garage when Keith pointed the gun at him and Eskins and Santiago emptied his clip. Santiago gave the same description in his internal affairs statement and at trial. Here's his testimony.
Now, is it your testimony that you saw a male, not Officer Eskins, also run across Reisterstown Road?
I saw a black male with a gun running and also Officer Eskins.
So if you're on Belvedere, and Reisterstown Road runs perpendicular, like this table is Reisterstown Road, mm-hmm. and I'm going on Belvedere. The individual you say is running across Reisterstown Road, correct?
That's correct.
And their left side is to you, correct?
The left side of?
His left side, because you're on Belvedere.
Yes.
His left side is to you, is
that's
that right?
That's correct.
And you are how far away from this individual?
Not that far, it's maybe like a quarter of a block from the corner.
A quarter block from the corner?
Yes.
And so from a quarter block from the corner, it's your testimony that you can see an object in the person's right hand?
That's correct.
What were they doing with this thing in their right hand?
Holding it.
How were they holding it?
Like this.
Like this?
Mm-hmm.
Were they pointing the thing at somebody?
At that point, no.
So you could see the object, and you described it how?
Because I saw that it's like it's an automatic gun, it's a dark colored gun, and it's flat because the revolver is a cylinder. And he was running and swinging.
So it wasn't silver?
No, it's the dark color gun.
So you wouldn't describe it as a silver gun?
No.
Officer Philippou's description of the gun, like several other key details, evolved between her statement in January 2016 and her trial testimony. The best she could offer IAD was that the gun was large. 1 month later, she recalled a lot more.
Do you recall if you actually walked over to the refrigerator or not?
Yes, I walked over. I saw the gun Macy placed up there. It was a darker handgun. I actually thought it looked a little bit weird just because it was like a multicolored handle. Looked like something like from like maybe the 70s or something.
Groovy, baby. Officer Eskins also was consistent when describing the gun to Internal Affairs and then on the witness stand, but he was also unusually succinct. Here's his statement to Internal Affairs.
Can you describe the weapon again?
I can't even begin to tell you what it looked like.
And his testimony at the armed robbery trial was even more curt.
Can you describe that gun?
No, ma'am.
I'm sorry?
No, I cannot describe that gun.
Can you describe the color?
No.
Do you have any descriptions whatsoever about this item that you said was a gun?
Nope.
How's that for a description? Nope. I've got a theory for why Eskin's photographic memory of the incident missed such a key detail. I'll let my ex-BPD buddy, Larry Smith Jr., explain.
Now, Eskins says he sees the guy with a gun. He chases the guy. He sees the gun the entire time. They're in the garage. He sees him pick the gun up. He sees him point the gun, but he can't describe the gun. All of this, but he can't describe the gun. Because I don't think he knew... I don't think he knew what gun they put there to describe.
Ding, 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 ding. Eskins did leave the scene almost immediately. Maybe he didn't get a good look when he came back. The grip of the gun, made of laminated wood, has an almost marbled look in shades of greenish blue and a little bit of yellow, depending on the light. In the photos, the grip is covered in a thin layer of blood, with a few blood drops on the closed slide. There's also blood on the trigger and the butt of the gun, where the magazine is inserted. The blood doesn't look dry, but it also doesn't look fresh and wet either. But that makes sense, since the photos were taken several hours later. It looks, I don't know, sticky. One thing that bothers me, though, if this gun, at the time it was placed on top of the fridge, was covered in Keith's fresh blood, I would expect to see some evidence of blood on top of the bright white refrigerator. A few drops, a smear or two. The gun isn't a flat form, so not every part of it is touching the surface. And in some of the photos, you can actually see underneath it. And there doesn't appear to be any blood there either. The barrel is pointing forward towards the front of the garage, and it's perfectly straight and perpendicular with the edge of the refrigerator door. Altogether, it looks like it's been placed there so carefully and cautiously so as not to disturb any part of its immediate surroundings. It's just strange. The gun on its own, though, sitting on top of the fridge that Keith was hidden behind, it's a not-so-great fact, but it was the prints on the grip that made it a bad one. The crime tech observed the ridge detail immediately and noted it in her report. At the trial, Baltimore Police latent print examiner Elizabeth Patty testified that she examined the entire gun and its magazine for possible prints and took four lifts, all from the gun's bloody grip. Three of those lifts were suitable for comparison, she wrote in the first of two reports. By that point, she had been provided with a suspect name and a set of their known prints, so the lifts were not entered into the computer database. Instead, she visually compared the three suitable prints to the known prints she was provided and concluded that lifts 1A and 4A matched Keith Davis Jr.'s right middle finger, and lift 2A was a match for the upper portion of his right palm. If the gun was planted, then the prints were planted too, and with Keith passed out at the scene, that would have been easy enough to do. But the medic was by Keith's side at 10:08 a.m., and then on their way to Sinai Hospital at 10:25. Keith was conscious until at least 9:58, when his phone call with Kelly suddenly went dead upon him being shot in the face. Fingerprint analysis is a subject I'll be discussing in more depth in a later episode, but for right now, let's just assume Elizabeth Patty's conclusion is correct. That would mean the cops had 10 minutes to obtain a random gun and plant Keith's prints before the medic arrived. Is that possible? With four police vehicles directly on scene, two more a few blocks up the street, the district station just a quick jog away, and unsupervised access to an auto repair garage full of God knows what, yeah, I'd say it is. Proving it, or at least getting a jury to believe it, is the challenge. Here's Zach Zweigel, a member of Team Keith.
What do you see as being the worst evidence for Keith?
Yeah, I mean, I think so much of it revolves around the gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's one of those things where I think it comes down to whether you as a juror are willing to believe that guns are planted. You know, if you're willing to believe it, then you're willing to cast doubt on the entirety of what surrounds the gun. If you're not willing to believe that, then it's really hard to separate Keith from the gun, you know, because either you're willing to believe that police took a gun and pushed it up against an unconscious person's palm and middle finger and planted prints, or you're not. You know, some of us, that's incredibly easy to believe because it's happened before. Like, this is not, it's not a new concept. But for other people, I think whatever their prejudices are, whether for or against people and police, I think it becomes one of those things where, you know, it's just too conspiratorial. They wouldn't do, you know, whatever people use to justify their own, you know, predispositions on the way that these investigations go down.
Before jury deliberations, the prosecution took 4 of the 5 prohibited gun charges off the table, leaving them with firearm possession with a felony conviction and 15 counts from the original indictment to decide. By then, Keith had rejected the state's plea offer of 15 years in prison, the first 5 without the possibility of parole, in exchange for pleading guilty to 5 charges. Those were attempted armed robbery, 2 counts of first-degree assault on Eskins and Santiago, firearm use in the commission of a felony violent crime, and that lingering prohibited gun charge.
You really a prohibited person?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, I hear you. I understand.
Yes.
It didn't take very long for the jury to return their verdict. They acquitted Keith Davis Jr. of all charges but that one. The state and their officer witnesses had failed to convince them beyond a reasonable doubt that Keith was guilty of attempting to rob or harm Charles Holden, of assaulting Lane Eskins and Alfredo Santiago, or failing to obey their lawful orders. They'd even rejected the state's fingerprint evidence, the verdict would suggest, since they also acquitted him of wearing, carrying, and transporting a handgun. Here's Megan Kenny breaking down a verdict that remains difficult for many to rationalize.
15 not guilties, 1 guilty. That 1 guilty was illegal possession of a firearm due to a prior felony conviction that Keith had and served time for. I believe it was I can't remember what it was. It was some drug charge. So, think about that. Of the 15 not guilties, one of it was not guilty of a possession of a firearm, wear, carry, transport. And he was found guilty of illegal possession of a firearm, because he's not allowed to be around any handguns. So the fact that his bleeding, unconscious body was found by a gun, near a gun, he was found guilty of that.
The guilty verdict on just that last count came as a surprise to many in the courtroom. Here's reporter Baynard Woods.
The prosecutor kind of made this point that you can't not convict on this, and I know the defense has taken that as, rather than a rhetorical flourish, as a claim that jurors took to mean, look, this one isn't open for debate. It's this
right.
One you actually don't have a choice, rather than the rhetorical flourish of like, there's no way you could not possibly see this. But it was a surprising verdict. I got the sense at the time that where they didn't really see a contradiction is that people thought that, like, yeah, he clearly didn't rob this hack. And his story that he was just walking down the street is probably right. So, like, yeah, they chased the wrong guy and they shot the wrong guy. But the guy happened to also have a gun because it's Baltimore. And relying on this assumption of people seeing every night on the news, oh, my God, more people are shot. Oh, my God, more people are killed.
There were little signs for months that the state had something else planned. But guessing what it was would have been impossible. Their focus on that prohibited gun charge was one, plus the subpoenaed but unused cell phone records. There was also a letter Keith's attorney had received from the Baltimore Police Legal Affairs Department in September 2015, rejecting her request for a police report specific to the police-involved shooting. The use of force incident shared the same criminal complaint number as the pending armed robbery case, and so no records would be available until that case was closed. But there was one line that stuck out, that did not seem to fit, that referenced an ongoing murder investigation. The last big clue came at the tail end of the first trial, just before Kelly got on the witness stand. She was served with a subpoena for the grand jury by a bald-headed detective wearing a suit and a bow tie. His name was Mark Feeney, and Keith would eventually realize he recognized him from the day of his arrest when he was first taken down to Baltimore police, homicide. Keith made clear he would answer no questions without a lawyer present, so the interview ended before it began. But as it turned out, since almost immediately following the police-involved shooting, Detective Vini had been zeroing in on Keith. 5 hours earlier, on June 7, 2015, Vini had been assigned a new case, the murder of a 25-year-old named Kevin Jones. Here's how this homicide detective of 20 years explained his reasoning in 2017.
Didn't you testify that you went down to see what was going on to coordinate with the police-involved shooting?
I said that I encountered someone from the FIT unit, and I told him the type of gun that I was looking for.
That you were looking for a .22 caliber weapon.
I said I just came off of a murder, and I had .22 caliber shell casings on my scene. So I heard you all had a police involved. Any event that you recover a weapon, let me know.
And you were looking for a .22?
Yeah. It was not the 22 shell, 22 caliber shell cases was on my crime scene. So naturally, as a prudent investigator, you would tell people that if you see anything that could be related to the shell casings on my scene, if it's a gun involved, if it's a 22, let me know. Considering the fact of the short time span between the homicide investigation and then 4 or 5 or 6 hours, if you want to give it later, you have a police involved within a quarter of a mile away, it's only prudent to look to see if there's any relationship.
How often do you go to other detectives to tell them that you are looking for a 22 in a case that you're leading as detective?
So, what happens is, if you are in a hallway and you pass in a coworker and put yourself in the frame of mind of a detective, all right? It's just like when the officers change shifts, the patrol officers. When you change shift, you see the guy coming off on 4 to 12, you come in on at midnight, you say to him, hey, this happened earlier today. I'm looking for this. I'm looking for a guy on a Huffy bike, okay? And it's the same with this. I saw one of the detectives from the FIT unit, and I let him know that on my scene, I had 22 caliber cell casings. So, hey, I don't know what you all have. I didn't even know whether or not they had recovered a gun at that time. I just said I had 22 caliber shell casings from my murder scene. Let me know what type of gun you all recovered.
And when did this conversation happen?
It happened the same day as the murder, because I saw an individual from the FIT unit who obviously, I don't know if he had responded out to the scene or not. I just saw him and I said, hey, I'm just coming in off of a murder, so I had 22 caliber shell casings. Let me know if you all get a gun from your scene.
Okay, so you didn't speak to the investigator in the police-involved shooting. You just ran into any random detective and said, this is what I'm looking for.
So I wouldn't describe him as random at all. What was his name? I just worked with him because he got promoted. His name is Glenn. He was on the elevator, and I saw him. We riding up on the elevator, and I told him what... I had 22 caliber shell casings on my murder scene. Let me know what you all find out about your police involved. That was it. That was it.
Is it your opinion, or was it your opinion at that time, that Glenn was investigating the police involved shooting?
He's a member of the FIT unit. It's just like I'm a member of homicide. If you want to talk to one of the other detectives and you can't get them, you can talk to me, and I'll pass the information on.
Did Glenn write this down?
No.
Did you write this down?
No.
That's it for now, listeners. Thank you so much for joining me these last 6 weeks. I will be back in mid-July for 4 more episodes in this series as Keith Davis Jr. begins his 4th and hopefully last trial for the murder of Kevin Jones. If you think this story has been maddening so far, prepare yourselves because there are plenty of twists, turns, and tidbits from Vini's detective friend Glenn ahead. God, is somebody cutting onions in here? Or did I just get a little emotional? Whew. Thank you so much to everyone who has helped make this series possible, especially Rabia, Susan, and Colin for allowing me to bogart their podcast for several more weeks than originally planned. I appreciate that so much. Thank you. I'm also so grateful to Hannah McCarthy, who edited this last episode and put up with my very, very last minute changes. Thank you for that. Thank you so much to sound producer Rebecca Lavoie for her masterful editing all season long, as well as her ideas and support. Thank you so much. Thank you as well to Meetul Talhan, who made sure I got every last extra episode I wanted and never seemed to mind the slightest bit when I was super duper late on things. Thanks as well to our transcription team, Erica, Britta, Skylar, and Dawn. I appreciate you ladies so much. I need to also give a personal shout out to my dear, sweet 13-year-old dog, Luca, who has put up with so many all-nighters and way less walks than usual for the last few months. Thank you, sweet girl. Thank you to everyone who has agreed to be interviewed for this podcast. Your insights have been so invaluable. Thank you so much to our listeners who came along for this ride so far. I hope you will be back in 6 weeks for its conclusion. In the meantime, follow Undisclosed on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod, and be sure to rank us on iTunes. Lastly, thank you so much to Keith and Kelly Davis for trusting me with your story. If there is any justice, this will be over soon. But Keith, please know that there are so many of us who will fight for you as long as it takes.